This project started in 1976, and Ruth has collected over
72 interviews we have.
Mm-hmm. Of black women. Ruth is going to present to us some slides showing us her work, and she's also going to talk about how she came to this work and what it has done and what she's planning to do. I'd like to turn you over to Ruth, who is no stranger to Oise. She was here a few months ago doing similar work.
Without slides, just showed up, I don't know how much later.
Yeah.
We almost didn't house them today, but they were sent Federal Express International yesterday, and they arrived.
Is that working?
Yes, this is working. At least it sounds to me as if it's working. Mm-hmm. You can hear me over the whir of the slides machine. I'm going to divide. Have you? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to mention that this event was able to take place with the help of
I'm going to divide this talk into two sections. First, I'll talk a little bit about oral history in general and what I have been doing at the Schlesinger Library. Then the second part, I have taken the theme of education as seen through the eyes of black women, Oral History Project interviewees. And so I have selected, I don't recall how many, maybe about 12, 13, 14 women. I will show slides, tell you a little bit about them, and then read an excerpt from their interviews. The project began at the Schlesinger Library in 1976. The Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe College has the full name, the Arthur and Elizabeth Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America. But there was a little failing. They didn't have much on the contributions of African-American women. And in 1975-76, there was a black woman professor from George Washington University in Washington, D.C., who was on the advisory committee to the library and suggested that the library do an oral history project. And the whole committee accepted that, and the library sought funding, began the project in the fall of 76, and I came to it in the spring of 77. The idea was that the library would collect 30 interviews with African-American women who were in their 70s and older. This would be women all throughout the United States with different backgrounds in terms of socioeconomic level, their educational level, whether they lived in the North or South or West or whatever. When the information was put out in the publications that there was going to be an oral history project, people started writing in, telephoning in, whatever, and we collected about 400 names in the files. The advisory committee selected perhaps 100 women as potential interviewees, and with the time and the money, well, we had, the money kept coming as I kept collecting interviews because we had to find money to transcribe them. But with the time and money that we had, we finally did 72 interviews. And each woman's life is in a separate bound volume on various library shelves. Written into the project proposal was the idea that the material collected would be deposited in a number of institutions throughout the United States. So there are about 13 depositories. Some of them predominantly black colleges, some places like Columbia University, University of California at Berkeley. So the material has been distributed over a period of time. And I have completed, when I say completed, gotten to the final bound stage, 69 of the 72 interviews. And I don't know whether I'll live long enough to complete the others because one of them, well, just, the interviewers, let me back up a moment, the interviewers did not have specific questions. They just had general topics, general areas that we wanted covered, and I'll tell you about those in a moment. But out of the same list of general topics, the shortest interview is about an hour and a half, and the longest, this is the one I say I don't know whether I'll live to complete, was 27 90-minute tapes, over 1,000 pages of raw transcript, as I'm working on other projects at the moment. So the tapes came to my office. I had transcribers to work on them. Then we sent the material back to the interviewer and interviewee to edit. And when we began, we did not have a word processor. So every time it came back from somebody's editing, the whole thing was completely retyped. So some of the transcripts went through three or four retypings, but by 1980, I think it was, we finally had a word processor. Each woman signed a legal agreement. We had different types of legal agreements, and if you want more information, I can do that when we ask do the questions. So each woman signed a legal agreement as to what would happen with her transcript. The material was completed, as I said, and sent to the institutions around the United States. And those institutions that were not depositories could purchase transcripts. Most recently, the Meckler Corporation has published a 10-volume set of the transcripts. And it includes only 66 of the interviews. But it took a year and a half of my life to track down these women again. The interviews had all been completed by 1980, and we had no idea that there would ever be any commercial publication. So that was not written into the original legal agreements. So in order to do this, I had to track down the women, and I was tracing heirs of estates and executors and sisters and brothers to get permission to do this new publication. So that came out in January of 1991. Yeah, just this year. Another thing that happened was the traveling photographic exhibit called Women of Courage. And that's where the slides have come from. In 1980 or so, a woman contacted me. She was a freelance photographer. She said that she had read about the project and was interested in making some kind of a contribution. So I arranged some letters of introduction to a number of women in the New England area. And then this photographer, Judith Sedgwick, as far as I was concerned, just disappeared, and I thought that was the end of it. But I think it was 8 or 9 months later, she called me up and said, I have some photographs that I would like to show you. She had just done this on her own time and money whenever she had the opportunity. And the photographs so impressed the people at Radcliffe College that they decided to raise money. And we decided that she would do maybe 10, 15 more photographs. And by the time she had completed, say, 30 altogether, we were thinking, the Radcliffe said she has to do as many women as possible. So she and I began to think of the possibility of an exhibit, though we didn't know when it would come to fruition. But in 1984, in March, she was visiting a friend at the New York Public Library, and she had three of the photographs in her portfolio. She was going to New York to show her work to someone. And the people at the New York Public Library saw the photographs and asked more about it and said, oh, can we have the exhibit? Well, at this point, we didn't have the exhibit. And so when Judith came back, she said the New York Public Library is interested. And New York Public Library wanted an exhibit that would open in December of that year. So we said, okay, let's go for it. Let's go all out. So we developed the traveling photographic exhibit called Women of Courage, and it's been on the road since December 1984. And I have some bookings into 1993 at this point. And it's just been word of mouth that's carried it, because I have not had time to go out and look for sites for it. And someone would see it and tell someone else, and they'd call or write and say, can we have the exhibit? So it's gone to colleges, it's gone to some public schools, it's gone to historical societies, public libraries, all kinds of situations. Now, I think that just gives you just very general idea of what the project was about. So I would like you to ask questions if you have any, and that I will speak more to things that I know interest you about the project. Yes?
No. You're just talking about how great an idea would be doing something that is maybe.
Yes, yes. It would be. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. They were just talking about translating something like this into Canadian terms and women of different ethnic origins. But we started with the Black Women Project, and I'm currently working with a Latina group and a Chinese American group so we can help them develop their oral history projects that will go to the Schlesinger Library. And I can tell they're going to be very, very different from the Black Women Project. Yeah.
How did you select the women?
How did we select the women? Well, we simply said women who had made significant contributions to improving life for Black Americans and by extension for all Americans. And I would compile lists, maybe 30 names, with a brief paragraph about each woman, send them to the advisory committee members. There were maybe a dozen women, educators primarily, you know, college professors, that type of person who was on the advisory committee. And we would meet and go through the list, and they would say, oh, this one looks interesting, that one looks interesting. And some of it was just serendipity, and let me give you an example of that. There's one woman in the project whose name is Jessie Abbott, and she taught at, she didn't teach, she was a secretary at Tuskegee Institute in Tuskegee, Alabama. And all we knew about her was that she was a secretary and that she had helped her husband, Cleve Abbott, who had developed the men's athletic programs at Tuskegee. And we just selected her on the basis of the importance of Tuskegee Institute in the education of Black people. So when her interview came in, we found that she had been a secretary to Mrs. Booker T. Washington, and Booker T. Washington had founded Tuskegee. Then she was the secretary to Mrs. Jenny Moton, and Jenny Moton's husband, Robert Russo Moton, had succeeded Booker T. Washington. And last, she had been a secretary to George Washington Carver for a number of years. So we have all this wonderful information about George Washington Carver, what it was to like to work with him, and she described him as a mischievous little boy, and they used to write sort of nasty notes to each other. So it was just, we didn't know that we'd get this wonderful information about all these people and about Tuskegee. And so some of it was just, well, serendipity or potluck. And some of it we really knew what we would be getting.
Mm-hmm. Kind of ballpark cost figures for such a project. I mean, you'd be going to 76, I think, if you have us written down. But in terms of the 72.
Yeah, okay. So I have to do it in, I haven't added it up. The first funding, when they hoped to do the 30 women, I think we got around $132,000, and that was that's what the proposal was. And that was to be for 3 years and 30 women. I mean, it's just terribly expensive to transcribe. This would have been 76. Then that money ran out, say, in 79, and we got a small grant from a local bank of $7,500. Then we had a grant from one of the women in the project. She gave us $5,000. Then we had, there's a national Black women's organization called The Lynx, and they gave us, I think it was $12,000. And then finally, the Ford Foundation, I can't remember now, but I think it was $10,000 that we got from them. So 7, 5, 12, 14, 16, 3, 4, 5, 6, 167,000 to complete the work to the point that it's been done. And that included most of the time the binding for each woman's transcript. So it included money for interviewers. We paid them token, really. It was $250 that each interviewer got, and that it didn't matter whether she went 1 hour or 20 hours. It was just a token thing of $250, and we paid transportation. It was a national project, so we had to pay hotel and train or airfare. And then to distribute the transcripts, the depositories were receiving them all free of charge, and that included the binding until we finally ran out of money, and we still distributed the text, but we asked them to pay for the binding if they wanted it. And then it included producing this guide to the transcripts. And I think, yeah, I think that's about what was covered by that. $167,000. Mm-hmm. That was entirely separate. Mm-hmm. The photography exhibit she was asking about, and that was entirely separate.
I have a question. I'd like to go back to the secretary. Did she speak at all during the interview about what it was like for her to work as a secretary and what her
She was asking about the woman that I mentioned, Mrs. Jessie Abbott, and what it was like to, did she speak about what it was like to work as a secretary and what her aspirations were. She went to Tuskegee because her husband went there, and she was just looking for some kind of work. And I can't recall what kind of training she had had as a secretary. I don't recall her mentioning that she had really had training as a secretary. But looking for some kind of work, that's where she ended. And she developed women's athletic programs at Tuskegee Institute and went with the track team, for instance, the women's track team. And she mentioned they're going to the Olympics at one point. And there was quite a bit about women's track. And she also mentioned, because at that time, the difficulties in the South and Black people couldn't go to hotels. And she mentioned taking the students for track meets, and they would go in cars, they would find places, as she said, they couldn't stop at gasoline stations or anything, and so they would just go in the woods to go to the bathroom, and she mentioned heating up cans of beans on the radiator of the car so they could get food to eat because there was no place that they could stop. And then they would travel all night, and they would end up at some Black college where they could stay. But under these stringent conditions, these women were just constantly winning athletic meets, at the track meets. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Can you talk a bit about the process of editing the interviews, and how much, as well as how much consultation actually took place between the women who were interviewed and the women who were editing?
Okay, she's asking about the editing of the interview. When the interview was transcribed, I asked the transcriber basically to just put down everything that was there. And one other person and I did the editing. There's a great difference of opinion about editing. I very strongly believe that these transcripts should be as near as possible to the tapes. The tapes are your primary source document. And if people want, I feel that basically you shouldn't transcribe. But if people are going to transcribe, I feel that they should do as little editing as possible. But I know many institutions just change everything and make nice, neat grammar, and I figure you lost the flavor of that person if you begin to do that. So when I first began, the director of the library would often be overseeing my work, and then she decided, well, I guess that was okay, and just was on my own for all these years that I worked on it, maybe after the first 3, 4, 5 months or something like that. And so I just tried to leave as much of the flavor of the person as possible. There's one woman, I recall, that we had to do a lot of editing because she used the phrase, you know, say five times in a sentence. So we would often take out the you know, and maybe leave it once in every three sentences or something. But I tried to do as little editing as possible, and I know that I'm sort of on the, you know, the far end of the way people believe editing should be done. Yes? She's asking whether the women who were interviewed had a chance to see the transcript. After the transcribing, my staff and I, when we did preliminary editing, first editing, and we would make a list of questions that we wanted answered, and that could be because there was something the transcriber couldn't understand, and it could be because of the interviewee had mentioned somebody's name, first name, and hadn't given us a last name, because we were planning to do an index for each transcript. It would be a personal name and institutional name index. So after this first editing, the transcript was sent to the interviewee first with the list of questions and then to the interviewer, and we asked them to try not to really rewrite this interview, but just to answer the questions and leave it as much as possible the way it was when it came to them. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, she was asking whether some people wanted to clean it up. Well, the people who did the most cleaning up were women who were authors. Then second were women who had been English teachers. And the others, on the whole, felt fairly comfortable with it and didn't make too many changes. But one woman who was an English teacher in the South, when she saw it, she said, people just think I can't speak at all, that I don't know anything. And she asked to have it withdrawn. So I just didn't do any work on it maybe for another couple of years. And then I sent it to her, and she felt okay the second time around. So it's been interesting dealing with some of these. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have chosen as my theme this evening the importance of education as seen through the eyes of these women who were interviewed in the Black Women Oral History Project. I do all kinds of different things, and I just thought that education, considering the institute we were working in this evening, might be a good theme. So I'm going to be doing some reading at this point. And if you have some more questions you want to ask me at the end, that'll be fine. So it seems there's always been some controversy around Black education. And the questions range from why and how much and whether and who's going to get it and what kind and when. And so the issues have been why should Black people receive an education if they're only going to be domestic workers or laborers? And before that, whether applied to the slaves. And if they were able to read and write, then they would perhaps no longer be amenable to being somebody's property and having no rights as human beings. And the questions of what kind of education, should it be a vocational or should it be academic? But whatever these questions, African Americans have always sought education. And often white Americans have tried to provide it in some ways. In colonial times, one way was through Christianity, teaching slaves to read, especially so they might be able to read the Bible and then they might become converted. But the Church of England established that freedom would not necessarily come about because of conversion to Christianity. So there was a little tension there. But the Quakers advocated education for Black people. And they worked not only to abolish slavery, but also to establish schools. And they encouraged slaveholders to give instruction, some minimum instruction, to their slaves. And there were many blacks, both free and slave, who became the artisans of the colonies through the occupational training that was provided. And blacks who were free and could read and write taught this to slave blacks. There were legal restrictions surrounding the education of blacks, both in the North and the South, in some way, right into the 20th century. So let me give you some idea of the kinds of restrictions. Education, in a sense, was a part of the American philosophy, but there was some dissension among the founders of the American Republic. There were those who favored full education for African Americans and those who favored only an occupational education. And there was division on the education of slaves. In general, it was against the law to educate slaves. But some masters and mistresses or their children would teach slaves to read and write. Then later, when black children could attend public schools, there were often separate schools for them. And this was true in the North as well as in the South, though legal segregation in Northern schools ended much earlier. And in many situations, black and white students in the North attended schools together. The Civil War and Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves, and there was no longer any prohibition against teaching them. So education was often then developed as the part of public school system. Public school system, though the schools might be separate. And outside of public school systems, religious groups, both black and white, opened schools in the North. White teachers, primarily women, came from the North to set up schools. And Congress, the U.S. Congress in 1865, authorized what came to be known as the Freedmen's Bureau. And General Oliver Otis Howard became commissioner and worked to further the education of Negroes, as they were then called. And the Bureau operated several thousand schools throughout the South before it was disbanded in 1874. In the early years of the 20th century, there was a philanthropist, George Rosenwald, who opened schools, contributed to schools, and John D. Rockefeller and George Peabody supported school construction and salaries for teachers. And it was in the early years after the Civil War that many of the so-called historic black colleges were founded. Some were founded as land-grant colleges, and some were organized with private funds, such as those of the American Missionary Society, which founded Atlanta University. It was not Atlanta University at the time, but the American Missionary Society founded what became Atlanta University. Some schools began with their own buildings, and some began in people's homes. But the purpose of it was to fill the gap, to prepare former slaves to become contributors and full participants in American society. And although some of these institutions were called colleges, they were teaching the basic three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic. Very basic instruction. Occasional institutions in the northern part of the United States would accept black students, though with various kinds of restrictions. And one of the exceptions was Oberlin College, which was founded in 1833, and even before the Civil War accepted black students. But the acceptance of Negro students at Oberlin showed the lack of facilities in the United States for training at the college level. So with each century, education has become a more important aspect of American life. And an educated electorate really is demanded by the structure of the American government. And in a way, school was considered the place for making good citizens. But again, American schizophrenia did not really think of the Negro as a citizen. So with this as a background, I want to turn to talking about some of the women in the Black Women Oral History Project. But we interviewed them for their life stories. We asked questions about family background, that is parents, grandparents, other forebears, brothers and sisters, and we ask questions about their childhood, the socioeconomic level of the family, significant events and influential persons in their childhood, and we asked about their education, beginning with elementary school, continuing on to college or professional school, whatever. And there were questions about significant influences on their lives and about how being black and female affected, or how they felt being black and female affected the choices and options in their lives. And we asked about their personal circumstances, such as marriage and children, and their husband's attitude toward their career or activities. So from these interviews, there are many stories about education, the desire for an education, the lengths to which a family would go to get an education for their children, restrictions on their education, family and friends who encouraged or discouraged them, and about teachers. So let me begin. This is Mary Thompson. She lived from 1902 to 1985. She practiced for over 40 years as a dentist. And from 1937 to 1947, she went with the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority to Mississippi, working on something called the Mississippi Health Project. And they went to Mound Bio, Mississippi, to take medical care and dental care for the needy. But in Massachusetts, she helped organize a fair housing committee and help establish a branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So I'm going to read you a little bit of what she had to say about her education. I worked. Sometimes I worked after school, and then I worked during the summers. I used to work down here waiting tables during the summer. And one winter, I worked at a little restaurant. I would go to school from 9 till 5, and then I would go down to Beacon Street. I worked in the kitchen there, washed up the pots and pans and dishes, then scoured the table, shined the brass faucets, washed the dish towels. I didn't do this alone. There were two other people with me. And we scrubbed the floor and left it all ready for the next day. I think they just served lunch and dinner down there. At the time, I didn't have too much time to study. So when exams came, maybe a week before, my mother would fill in for me and I would cram for the exams. I think I only did that one year.
It's not working. Lois Jones.
She was born in 1905 in Boston. She was an instructor and professor of design and watercolor at Howard University in Washington, D.C. for over 40 years. And she's had many one-woman shows in the United States and abroad. And in 1973, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts presented a retrospective show covering 40 years of her painting. I went to the Bowdoin School, which is in what we call the West End. This is Boston she's speaking of. And that was a school which was in a Jewish neighborhood. I went there and then finally to the High School of Practical Arts, which was an unusual school because it gave me the opportunity to do special study in art. I think I was searched out because of the talent that I seemed to have expressed in the grammar school. I was sort of singled out as a good prospect for the High School of Practical Arts. I was just about to say that Miss Laura Wentworth, who was the advisor for the students, took a great interest in me, and also Miss Grace Starbird, who was the head of the art division. They followed me through my career for years. As a matter of fact, I was made art editor of the school magazine, which was called The Shuttle, and I used to do the drawings for the cover. Then it was also my job to head up a division of designing greeting cards, Christmas cards. And that had a great influence because later in life, as a freelance designer, I went on with that work in that field of designing greeting cards, so that it was all a grand build-up, a grand foundation as a student of the High School of Practical Arts, where I was greatly encouraged and admired by most everyone. It was an experience which strengthened me for the work that I was to do in later years. Next. You can try again. Fidelia Johnson. She was born in 1905 and was a teacher in the rural schools of Louisiana, and for many years involved at both the local and national level in the National Education Association and other teacher associations. She was a teacher and dean of women at Grambling State University in Louisiana, and her father, Charles Adams, had been president there. As early as I can remember, Charles P. Adams was a very strong man physically, and he had a good and a persistent mind. He also worked with people very diligently in the community. Naturally, I can remember the school in its early days when there was nothing here except woods and a few buildings. I'm told when he arrived in 1901 to establish this school, he was asked to come by a group of citizens who were farmers. This is a farming community. To establish a school similar to the school that Booker T. Washington had founded. They wrote to Booker T. Washington and asked for a man, and of course Charles P. Adams was the man that they recommended to come here and start a school. He came reluctantly, although he was Louisianian by birth. He had thought he would do something else after completing his work in Tuskegee, but nevertheless he did come to the state and he started the school in 1901. Next. Frances Albert. She lived from 1898 to 1987. She was a social worker. Sorry. She was a social worker, political and community leader. During World War II, she was a welder and at the same time a volunteer with the Red Cross, the USO, the daycare, Visiting Nurse Association, and the NAACP. And she was a Democratic Central Committee woman in Alameda County, California for 18 years. She was instrumental in eliminating discrimination in the hiring of teachers in the Berkeley schools. And in her interview, she spoke of Booker T. Washington. He was a hero all over the United States, educational hero. I didn't feel it at the time. I didn't know he was a famous man. He was just Mr. Washington to us kids, just the person that we knew who headed the school. We didn't realize that he was going to be so famous. The same way with Professor Carver. I never realized I was going to school to a distinguished scientist. He was just another teacher who taught me botany. Mr. Washington administered the school. He didn't have time to teach. He traveled and lectured and raised money for the school. He had many problems, and he was starting different things, especially agriculture. He kept, as long as he lived, a large night school. Boys and girls came to Tuskegee. I'd see them come to Tuskegee with just a little knapsack and $10. $10 was the entrance fee. That's all they had, but they wanted to get an education. They felt it was needed. Those students came to Tuskegee to work their way through school. There were 300 or 400 students at the night school all the time. They would work on the farm during the day to raise vegetables for the day students and in the chicken department, the dairy department, and all over. They would go to school just 3 hours at night, and it took them 2 years to make one grade, but they stayed. Many of them finished school and got a trade. It was a boarding school, except for those who lived in Tuskegee within 5 or 6 miles who lived at home. Some of the students lived at home and went to school, but the rest of it was a boarding school. He never turned away any students who said they wanted to go to school. Next, please. Zelma George was born in 1903, and she has done so many things. She's a musicologist, sociologist, an actress, a singer, a writer. She's been a dean of women, a caseworker, a probation officer, and she's active in many areas of community, national, international affairs, and has received many honors and awards. And in 1960, she was an alternate delegate with the United States delegation to the United Nations. I won't go into that. That's one of the fascinating things that she talked to us about. But my theme is education. Well, the thing I didn't tell you is that my mother and father, both educated people, did not put me in public schools until I was in the fifth grade. My mother taught us at home. She organized classes for whatever grades her children were in. She would invite three or four other children in so we would have competition and a classroom atmosphere. Wherever we lived, one room in our house was a classroom. My father would often join my mother as teacher, especially in history and math, but my mother taught all the courses, really. When we moved to Dallas, Texas, and the schools were a little better than they had been anywhere we'd been before, my parents put us in public school. I was given tests and put in the fifth grade. So my basic education was really at home by two very capable people who had been professional teachers. Next. Alice Donegan lived from 1906 to 1983, and she was the first black woman journalist admitted to the U.S. Congressional Press Galleries. She was a White House correspondent and chief of the Washington Bureau of the Associated Negro Press. Well, my parents were just common laboring people. My father was a sharecropper, and my mother was a laundress. And of course, I came up under very poor circumstances in a rural area, about 2 miles from the very small village of Russellville, Kentucky. One of the things I remembered best is what I just mentioned about my interest in education. I always wanted to go to school, even when I was only 3 or 4 years old. When my big brother would go to school, leaving me at home, I would always cry. I wanted to go to school with him. Of course, I couldn't go because we had a distance of about 2 miles one way, 4 miles a day, and naturally, I was too small to take that long journey. But my teacher, the primary teacher in the school which my brother attended, told my mother on one occasion that when I reached the age of 4, if she would buy me what they called in those days a penny pencil and a tablet and let me come to school whenever she felt I should come, she would teach me to read. That was a great day in my life. My mother would let me go to school about every Friday, and I was taught along with the regular primary class. At the age of 6, when I was entering school officially, I was ready for the first grade, which made me one grade ahead of the other children my age. And after I became regular school age, I attended school almost every day. Living a long distance from school, my mother would not let me go out on a rainy or snowy day. When I had to stay home, I cried all day. If it stopped raining about 10 o'clock in the morning, she would let me go to school if I could get there by noon in time for the afternoon classes. Next. The acceptance, exception to the 70 and older age, and this because she has been very ill, and we thought the importance of her contribution just made it necessary to interview her. But she worked on behalf of black children in the Boston area, was the founder of something called Operation Exodus, a program to improve education in the Boston schools. And she was an alternate delegate to the Democratic National Convention in 1968 and a delegate in 1972, and has done many other things. And she's currently a dean at Northeastern University in Boston. We knew about sit-ins through the NAACP actions, and in the school committee headquarters, we were aware of pickets because of the young people in CORE. We were aware of a lot of different strategies, but we weren't sure what strategy would be most appropriate to demonstrate what we were concerned about and at the same time realize some kind of result. The concern we had was because we didn't have a victim. The victim, as far as we were concerned, was our children, and therefore we felt they could not really suffer. So whatever kind of strategy we would devise or develop, we had to really think ultimately what it would do to them. And so we did think of all these things, because in some ways they had brought about some small but significant changes. We thought about picketing. We thought about human chains around the schools to keep the kids and the people from going in and demonstrate the plight that we thought that we were in and our concern. We thought about taking our kids' places and staying in the classrooms. We thought about boycotting again. But the bottom gnawing fear that we had and knowledge that we had is that our kids would be losing whatever small amount of education that they would receive if any of these strategies were used, because they would not be in the classrooms. She wrote a book about Operation Exodus and her experience in developing this program that bussed over, for a number of years, over 1,000 students, black students, where they could get better education in the Boston schools. Next. Muriel Snowden, 1916 to 1988. She was co-founder and co-director of Freedom House Boston, a human relations agency, human relations and advocacy institution. And she was very active in many professional and civic associations. She was the first woman and first black director of the Shawmut Bank of Boston. And she's the former overseer of Harvard College. And she was also a member of the Black Women Oral History Project Advisory Committee. Let's see. There's one other piece that I will tell you about as part of this conditioning process. There was a child, a girl, white, who lived two blocks from me. And every day, starting with kindergarten, she would come by on her way to school, because she had to pass my house and stop for me, and we would go to school together. I think that it was about the time we got to the third grade that Peggy said to me one morning, "I cannot walk to school with you anymore." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because I'm from Tennessee." That was her only explanation, and I wondered what was wrong with people from Tennessee. So what it had to do with was the black-white thing, and apparently this child's mother had said, "You cannot go to, you know, be friends or go to school with a little black girl." I decided in the third grade that I wanted to go to Radcliffe because I had a cousin, a woman who was my mother's cousin, who was a Radcliffe woman, and I was so impressed with this person. She was just such a wonderful woman, and she was brilliant. And I felt, if that's the school that can turn out somebody like this, then that was where I wanted to go. So I never thought about any other school. From the time I was in the third grade, I was going to Radcliffe, and you see how lucky I was, because not many people get to realize that kind of dream, and I went to Radcliffe. Next. Juanita Craft lived from 1902 to 1985, and she worked with civil rights activities in Dallas. She was involved in successfully opening the University of Texas to black students, a confrontation that culminated in the case of Sweat versus Painter. At the age of 73, she was elected a member of the Dallas City Council, and what she said was, when they asked why she was running, "Well, if you're not satisfied with what the other guy is doing, then you get out there and do it yourself." So she talked about education. Education was limited. I don't know where my grandfather learned to read. He could read printing, but he couldn't read cursive writing. He couldn't even write his name, but he could print his name. He was interested in his children getting an education, though. We had many hours together, and he liked to read history. When I was in high school, in the afternoons, we would sit and go through our history. He was interested in ancient history. Many of the events of Texas history, just a few years after Texas was accepted into the Union, the Texas Revolution at least, and he was interested. Next. Lucy Mitchell. Lucy was born in 1899, and she still lives in the Boston area. She's a specialist in early childhood education. She was educated from kindergarten through high school at the Daytona Normal and Industrial Institute, which was founded by Mary McLeod Bethune. And so Lucy had a lot to say about going to school there, so I'm going to read you some of that. With Mrs. Bethune, there were just no shortcuts. And another part of the character training, shall I call it, would be through these phrases that she would use, like, "Whatever you do, do it to the best of your ability." So this kind of feeling about thoroughness, to this day, any kind of sloppiness disturbs me greatly. I think another contribution that I would say she made to my life was her attitude toward work. For instance, she would say, any work is honest, however humble, and in whatever you do, strive to be an artist. Wasn't that a concept? To have it drilled into you that whatever you do, strive to be an artist. Next. Rosa Parks, born in 1913, civil rights leader, triggered the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. Well, my mother was my teacher part of the time when I was in rural school, I think about 3 years. I remember my mother's teaching very well, that she was very sincere. She didn't just put the work before the youngsters. If they needed any help, she would take time out to make sure that they were learning what she was teaching. One of the things that I always appreciated about her was if there was anything that came up of a racial nature, she never impressed upon me that even with segregation and going through a schoolhouse that was just a little shack, you might call it a shack, a building with no glass windows, she never impressed on me that that was the way it was supposed to be. Sometimes my grandfather and grandmother also, my mother's parents, I learned what it was like for them as small children during slavery and before emancipation. In our family, that's how we referred to the time of emancipation, as when the Yankees came through. The hardships, the struggles before the Yankees came through, to let the people know, the slaves know, that they were free. I felt that I was fortunate not to have been a child during that time, and that there was such a person as Abraham Lincoln who signed the Emancipation Proclamation. But I couldn't understand why, if we were a free people, that we had to be deprived of the better things, like a building. Next. This is Florence Edmonds, who lived from 1983, and the reason I know is because she's my mother. She was a public health nurse in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a graduate of the Lincoln Training School for Nurses in New York City. And for a time, she worked with the Henry Street Visiting Nurse Association in New York. And after marriage, she didn't work until the 1940s, Second World War, as we call it. And she taught first aid and home nursing for the Red Cross in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And the Pittsfield Visiting Nurse Association heard of her work and asked her to to join the visiting nurse. I don't remember too much. Oh, let me say, I did the interview. I interviewed her. I did two interviews in the Black Women Project, and this was one of them. I don't remember too much about school, as far as that goes. Had no problems, as I recall. Got along in school all right and did well. We had grammar, reading, writing, and arithmetic, which I think they need to pay more attention to the three R's these days than they do. No, it wouldn't hurt. I think we had exceptional teachers in school. In fact, I had geometry and algebra. And I remember I would have to teach geometry to you children because you never got it good from your teacher. And I was able to teach you your algebra and geometry. So that's why I say we apparently had good teachers, as I could remember those kinds of things. I graduated high up in my class in high school, valedictorian. And then another excerpt. Well, talking about sewing, I might mention this too. Your father had to hold down two jobs. This was after you children went to college, and the sewing more or less kept you in spending money. And I remember I used to tell you never to let yourself go broke, you children, but always to call home and get money, because we could get along without money better than you could in a strange place. But I was always afraid of the telephone bill. I never knew what it was going to say. But it was easier to call. I thought it was better to let them call and tell their problems, because by the time they wrote and you answered, the problem, the occasion, was over. So that's going to be the last slide. So education contributes to a higher quality of life. And I look at some of the young black women and men these days and wonder just what kind of life they're going to have. And it seems as if their lives are deteriorating, they're dropping out of school, and they become parents before they know how to take care of themselves. No jobs or no income, and they get involved in a lifestyle that's dependent upon drugs or whatever. So lack of education essentially means the menial and lower paying jobs and less stable in employment. And I realize that family structure has changed considerably since the participants in the Black Women Oral History Project were growing up and developing careers and raising and their families, but there's no way we can go back. The 20th century saw a change in lifestyle for black people from being primarily southern and rural to becoming northern and urban. But still, the institutions of the dominant group are determining what is available to the minority or other black group or other minority groups. And just so as examples, it determines the kind of education through tracking. I don't know what you call it here, but you know, the different levels. And it determines what areas of town or city are available for a large portion of this group to live in. And it determines small business loans. And it determines whether or not and how much police protection. And what about the schools? But it is through education that our mental horizons can be broadened, that we can come to understand what is being done to us as a minority group. So in the 1890s, when women's clubs were developing in the United States, black women were not accepted into white women's clubs, and they formed their own clubs. And the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs was organized in 1896. This is an organization that's still alive today. But the motto that they chose was "Lifting as we climb." And I feel that somehow we need to find our way back to that, and perhaps education is the key. Thank you. So it is late, but if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. Yes? Oh, someone named George in the back? He was asking, did any of the women complain about the Eurocentric bias of the education that they were receiving? And I would say, no, they didn't. One thing that I discovered was that in these southern schools that were segregated, they were already learning some black history. And in the North, the black students didn't receive this at all. And I would say a large proportion of the people in the project perhaps were educated in the South and then moved to the North or Western United States when they were perhaps teenagers or older. So no, there was nothing about that. And then you had a second question? I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you. He was asking, did we come across women who didn't want to tell about their life history? We wrote letters to women asking them if they were willing to be interviewed, and so we only interviewed women who said yes, they would agree to it. Yeah. She was asking about showing the exhibit to school children and how did they respond. You never can tell. The fourth and fifth graders, they sit there absolutely impassive, and you never know whether anything has gotten through or not. You just hope that maybe 5 years from that time, 10 years, they will look back and think of recall something that was said to them. You just don't know sometimes. Mm-hmm. But we developed a smaller exhibit called Women of Courage East, and this is women in the eastern part of the United States, because I've done a lot of work for the school volunteers for Boston, and they became very interested in the exhibit. And Digital Equipment Corporation wanted the exhibit, and they, I shouldn't say this, but they're the kind of group that call up and say, can we have the exhibit next month? Well, the exhibit is booked a year ahead of time. And so it got to the point where they said, well, would you develop a second exhibit? And I said, I really wasn't interested. I mean, just because they wanted it when they wanted it. And I said, I wasn't interested. And they said, well, what would you do if you had a second one? And I said, I would give it to the school volunteers for Boston so that public schools, private school students could have access to this information. So we finally, it took about 6 years, but we finally did develop a smaller traveling exhibit, and the School Volunteers for Boston does have it and is making it available to students. And they will have people that they're training and giving them information about the project and about the women's lives, so they will be able to talk to the students when they go into the schools.
I want to ask a question.
I must, before he asks the question, I'm about to say, this is my husband who is going to ask me a question, and I'm being prepared to be put on the spot.
Well, now, I hope it's okay. Where did I want to ask? Now, the operational word is education. It's your theme, right? Now, what I want to deal with is there's formal education, but there's the informal education in the home, how to behave, be gentle, considerate, and so on. Now, what I want to deal with is, could it possibly be that we undervalued the work of women who in the home shape their children into behavior, you know?
Okay, he was saying that there's formal education and informal education, the formal being going to schools, et cetera, and have we undervalued the kind of education that is received in the home? And as you read the interviews, you'll find that many women pay tribute to their mothers particularly, but to their fathers also, for the opportunities that even they had in the home. One of the things I found interesting, when I've worked on the Women in Federal Government Project, in which we have 39 interviews with women who worked in different agencies in the U.S. federal government. In the 1920s and the 1930s, these black women were encouraged by their parents to go to school and receive an education, because if they did not do so, the only opportunities open to them would perhaps be domestic work. In the 1920s and 30s, these white women who were in the Women in Federal Government Project were begging their parents to let them go to school and receive an education. So I found it interesting that there were at this period of time, extremely opposite opinions on the value of education for a female. But these women did speak a lot of what had happened in the home and appreciated their parents for what they had given them. Well, I think you've been very patient. I appreciate your attention. Thank you.